Salutations, friends, and welcome to The Arcade. We are your video game podcast here with you for the week of Friday, August 19th of the year 2016. How's it going, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages? We thank you so much for joining us once again through iTunes, through our website, or perhaps even now through the Google Play podcast section, as we are now in that area of the Google atmosphere, landscape, environment, universe. I am Mike the Legend, one half of the dynamic tag team that brings you this weekly look at the world of video games, weekly, every week, weekly.
That is what weekly means. And this week, weekly, weekly thing, my name, my nickname this week is the man who can definitively say that Weird Al still has it.
You know, that is a very important thing to state, because we did have a chance to see Weird Al this week, and we recommend everyone out there see Weird Al.
Yeah, he's one of those performers that, while he is starting to get up there in age, he hasn't really diminished in quality. His performances are still really energetic and not particularly short.
No, it gives you a full 2 hours.
Yeah, and in that time, he doesn't pitch like some other singers that might have been around as long as him. He doesn't pitch anything down to, because he can't hit the notes anymore or anything. In fact, I would say maybe the opposite. There's a couple of songs where he kind of hits some pretty outrageous notes that I don't know why I didn't notice until before, but it's like Weird Al's got a pretty wild vocal range. But yeah, he's awesome. If you've never seen him live, his band is incredible. It's the same band he's had for like 35 plus years at this point.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think Jim Bermuda Schwartz, the drummer, has been with him the whole time, hasn't he?
Yeah, they met when he was recording his single, his first single, Another One Rides the Bus. And then he was just his drummer ever since. And then anytime Weird Al picked up a new guy for his band, he's kept him. So it's kind of like, I think that sort of speaks to the type of person Weird Al must be to work for as well. So just interesting too that it's just, he's technically a bona fide cultural icon in all sorts of different ways. I mean, he's not just a musician who's had some good songs. He's been like a media personality as well for the last, well, as long as I can remember. And just to be able to like see someone like that somewhat regularly, because he tours yearly.
He's pretty relentless in his touring schedule.
Yeah.
His latest album, Mandatory Fun, came out last year, but he's been touring it the whole time.
Yeah. And just for someone just to be able to see him like that is just kind of awesome. And, you know, if you've sort of been hemming and hawing about seeing him, like, oh, I'll catch him the next time he comes around, don't make the mistake I've made with a few bands and just thinking that, because there will be a day that he'll probably call it quits. I mean, let's hope it's not anytime soon, because that's the other odd thing about Weird Al is the fact that his music is still, like, when he puts out parodies of stuff still, it's still funny.
Oh, certainly, his comedic chops have not lost a step at all in the time he's been performing and been doing his parody musical stylings. If anything, they've gotten better.
Yeah, and I mean, if anything else, his parodies sort of, as someone who's maybe getting to be out of the demographic of the, you know, certain types of music now, it's helped me appreciate certain songs that I may not have heard before, because I don't actively know what these teenage pop stars are. Like, I, shy of Weird Al and South Park, I would have never heard of Lordy or Lord or however.
I think it's Lord.
Lord, yes. I wouldn't have heard of Lord. I mean, I would have never heard her song Royals until I heard Foil and saw the great video for it. And that's the other thing. Over the years, he's become friends with such like legit comedians. Like Patton Oswalt is in all of his videos pretty much now.
Patton Oswalt has looked up to him for a while. Brian Posehn,
yeah,
is pretty adamant in his love and fondness for Weird Al's music.
And, you know, I've seen other people in his videos too, like Sarah Silverman. And, well, the Tacky video had like a who's who of like ridiculous people in it.
Oh God, it did. And I know even in outside of his music videos, I know in interviews, The Lonely Island and Annie Samberg have really, really credited Weird Al with inspiring them to get into the musical comedy realm.
Yeah, because, I mean, before Weird Al and Frank Zappa, people weren't really funny with music. I mean, it was sort of not, like, you know, brushed aside as being sort of like a novelty. And while Weird Al may have sort of embraced that novelty aspect to a point, it's still a valid thing to listen to. Like, you're not just like listening to like some like Crazy Frog album that you're going to be sick of in 2 weeks and throw in the garbage.
No.
Something like that, which I would, that's what I would call a novelty personally, but I don't know.
And he always does try to balance out the albums, half parody material, half original material. And in going back and listening to some of his more recent albums of the past 10, 15 years, the original songs really stand out more, to me at least, in listening to them again, as just being better songs, because I don't really remember the parody, the original song that the parodies are based off anymore.
Yeah, which is sort of telling of his pop culture lasting appeal versus the pop culture that he's parodying.
Like, I had to really struggle to remember the source song for White and Nerdy, which, if you don't remember from 10 years ago, that song, White and Nerdy, was based off the hit by Chamillionaire, Ride and Dirty.
Yeah, and which I think might have even won some sort of award that year, maybe a Grammy or something?
Possibly, not impossible. I don't remember off the top of my head, but...
But he's not someone that I hear hip music people talking about very often.
Oh, certainly
not. He's not like Drake or something that people always bring up, or Kanye West or something like that.
Certainly not. He was a flash in the pan and gone as quickly as he came onto the music scene.
Same thing with like Amish Paradise. Do you remember Coolio?
I do.
Do you remember any of the lyrics to Gangsta's Paradise?
No. But goddamn, I can sing Amish Paradise off the top of my head.
Yeah. Me too. I did at the show.
You did the right thing. You and me both. And it's entertaining for all ages. I mean, the man really does still give it.
Yeah. And his band still does too.
And one thing I noticed during the show, and I don't know if you noticed this as well, but the attention to detail they have for some songs. As you can imagine with a Weird Al show, they have costume changes for some of the bigger hits. You know, obviously he dresses up in the fat suit for the song Fat. He'll put on his big maple leaf suit jacket for Canadian Idiot, but for the song Smells Like Nirvana, he dressed up and the whole band dresses up in their 90s grunge apparel. Now, it's not just enough that they were wearing flannel and, you know, their shirts and ripped up jeans that were common dress at the time, but also the bass player lowered his guitar strap.
Yeah.
So his guitar was basically around his knees.
He also played the same type of bass as Chris Novoselic of Nirvana as well. Like I think it was a Gibson Firebird. Not that matters to most of our listeners, but he played the same type of bass. That type of attention to detail I can really appreciate.
Of course you would notice the guitar.
Yeah.
I only saw where it was positioned.
Yeah.
That, it's down by his knees. That was a common thing back then.
Yep.
To play your guitar basically right barely off the ground.
Yep.
And then rest of the show, it was adjusting. It's at normal waist height.
Yeah, like the comfortable playing level.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, unless you're Chris Novoselic, who that must be the comfortable playing level for.
Well, maybe it was back then.
It still is. I saw a recent video.
Oh, really?
He still plays it like that. But he's also like 6'8". Maybe it's just a thing of his height or something. I have no idea.
Maybe his comfortable playing height, you know, looks odd because it's just down there, but it's normal height for everyone else.
Yeah, maybe. But, yeah, I don't know. Great show. If you've never seen them and have been sort of like kicking the tires, being like, maybe I'll see him soon. Do it. Just bite the bullet and watch him once. You won't be disappointed.
And then you'll go see him again.
Probably.
And again. And again. There's a good chance he'll come around to your town because he hits most towns.
Yeah.
which is pretty awesome. He'll play to any size audience.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen him in like an arena a couple times. I saw him in a bigger theater once, and theater to arena. I'm sure if the money or whatever was right, he would probably play a club, but you'd probably have to spend a fair amount for that, but
possibly, depends, talk to him. Depends what kind of club it is as well. And just what kind of airfare and accommodations you're providing as well. And also I really enjoyed that he started off the show, not just by playing the song Tacky, but replicating the video by coming through the, basement area of the theater he was playing in that we happened to see him in on Monday, and walked his way up onto the stage from his starting location inside the bowels of this theater. Also, that was a sketchy looking basement.
Yes.
We happened to see him in our hometown of Winnipeg, Manitoba, play at the Burton Cummings Theater, and my God, there are dead bodies in that basement.
There have to be. There
ghosts. Have to be. Like, murders have happened down there.
But to be fair, it wasn't always the Burton Cummings Theater. It was the Walker Theater, I believe.
For a very long time.
And it's been around for over 100 years. It's a heritage building.
It's an old vaudeville theater, too.
Yeah. I mean, any building that has that type of history must have had some sketchy stuff happen, especially in the murdery-looking basement, which people don't normally go to. I mean, most of those doors are closed off to the public.
For a reason.
I mean, you typically think that reason is because, staff only, maybe it's like a staff room. As the Weird Al intro proved, it was because it's sketchy as hell. And maybe there's a ghost that haunts that room. I don't know.
One at least.
Yes. But all that aside, that sidetracking aside.
Well, not really sidetracking, because as you mentioned, Weird Al is a pop culture force and entertainer and personality who's made appearances on a number of shows. We see him regularly now this season on Comedy Bang Bang.
Actually, that's true, yes.
He also does a voice on My Little Pony Friendship is Magic of Cheese Sandwich.
Ah.
That's what that was.
Okay, yeah. Yes. 'Cause he shows video clips of various media mentions and roles he's played and stuff through in the middle of songs, just sort of like as a way to keep people entertained between wardrobe changes and stuff.
He also does the voice of Darkseid on the new iteration of Teen Titans Go, which is actually pretty funny when you consider that Darkseid is, DC's Apocalypse, although preceded Apocalypse of the Marvel Universe, this big, dark, brooding, very strong, galactic, crushing force, and Weird Al does the voice. So, obviously loves cartoons and voice work.
He's also Banana Man in Adventure Time.
He is. As I said, he loves cartoons. He's done a lot of voice work on cartoons. And one of the cartoons he's appeared on, as we get in nicely to our first ludicrous leadoff, is The Simpsons.
Yeah, I mean, he's been on there a couple of different times.
Which, as a show, has a storied history.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, now we're into, 26 or 27 seasons?
Something like that. It's way up there.
Some absurd number where it's basically getting to the point of retiring soon. It's that old as a show.
Yeah.
And a number of actors, guest stars, guest voices have been on the show, and even some you wouldn't think would ever appear on the program.
Yeah, and let alone multiple times.
It's true, and one of those personalities who's appeared on The Simpsons as a voice more than once, as a voice you wouldn't think you'd ever hear on The Simpsons, is that of Stephen Hawking.
Yes, Dr. Hawking, one of the modern, well, really not fathers, but main figures in modern physics and theoretical physics and string theory and all these different things that he's noted for.
Mm-hmm.
He's been on The Simpsons more than once, which is kind of mind-boggling for a couple of different reasons. The first being that, well, he's just a scientist. I mean, he was never really a big media personality of any time, any stretch. He just sort of had all these crazy theories and, was a big notable figure in physics. So, of course, he had made media appearances because he had to explain them and stuff. But the second part of it is the fact that for the majority of, of me remembering who Stephen Hawking is, the fact that he's had to use a voice modulator or a synthesizer of some kind to speak for him because he's had Lou Gehrig's, I think it's Lou Gehrig's disease, or some kind of debilitating thing happened to him 30 plus whatever years ago,
mm-hmm.
where he's no longer able to use his own voice, but his voice has become that of this kind of robot sounding voice, which on the one hand you could just get any computer sounding voice that sounds like that just to do the Stephen Hawking voice. Why would you need to get Stephen Hawking? And I guess, you know, to the Simpsons credit, I feel like you need to get Stephen Hawking for legitimacy's sake. And that's the one thing, I mean, say whatever you want about Simpsons now, they have been legitimate with their, usage of, celebrity voices and stuff. If they are going to be doing, you know, some, impression of someone, it's going to be obvious that it's an impression.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to just try to pass off some voice as being someone's voice if it's not actually their voice, like
George Bush,
you know, or Clinton or something, mm-hmm. like obviously going to parody when it suits them, right, for making a joke at someone like that. But when they need to use someone like Stephen Hawking, they've been respectful and used the real guy for different things. And that was always kind of cool, but still not unheard of that Stephen Hawking would be on The Simpsons. I mean, he did sort of become a minor media figure, sort of, over the years.
He has, and he's appeared, well, on a number of programs, but in animated form on The Simpsons. I believe that's the only, to the best of my recollection, the only animated show he's made an appearance as himself. And now he can chalk up another first, to the best of my recollection, because thanks to a recent update to The Simpsons mobile game, Tapped Out, Stephen Hawking is now a mobile video game character.
Yes. As the update posted on Facebook for The Simpsons Tapped Out page, they wrote, and I quote, "Professor Stephen Hawking is coming to The Simpsons Tapped Out to take part in the town's greatest scientific discovery since Blinky the Three-Eyed Fish. Will you be able to save Springfield from science?" And it continues on, "Join Professor Hawking as you explore the secrets of black holes, stop an army of robots, and listen to one of his lectures on string theory." Probably shouldn't have ended on that one, in classic Simpsons joke style. But yeah, that's very, very interesting that they would include Stephen Hawking for some reason in this video game.
I suppose they're doing some kind of future-themed update to it, and why not Stephen Hawking?
Now, I wonder if there actually will be any string theory lectures in the game.
I'd be disappointed if there wasn't.
Yes. I mean, they put it in the press release. Why wouldn't it be there?
That should be one of your rewards for completing a mission or successfully defending Stephen Hawking from an army of robots. You get to hear him talk about string theory. That is your great reward.
Or do you get to play as Stephen Hawking?
Well, as we saw in that one episode when he first appeared in 1999, they saved Lisa's brain. His wheelchair can do many different dynamic things.
That's true.
I mean, it's a helicopter. It's got loaded boxing gloves in there. And it also acts as a wheelchair and can talk for him. But
yeah,
it's pretty pimped out. It's like Exhibit got to it.
It's true. It's true. They pimped his ride. For another outdated reference that I'm sure millennials listening to our show will not understand.
Absolutely not, because it was a program that aired on MTV back in the day when people watched MTV.
Yes. But
speaking of things millennials do these days now, it is one of the things they do enjoy doing is going out to hunt for Pokemon in Pokemon Go.
Yes. Like the Gen Yers. I've come to the conclusion, just as a brief aside, that I feel like even though the classification for millennial being born after 1980 is out there, I don't know. I feel like if you're born after 1990, you should be a millennial, and before that, you're Gen Y, because that's what I thought. I thought I was like Gen Y, and then I heard this millennial thing being referred to like the youths, and it was already I've already felt like I'm like, I don't really understand their culture to a point. Why am I being lumped in with them? But But yes, much like the Gen Ys before the millennials is basically the whole reason why I said that, we're playing things like Pokemon Red and Blue. The millennials are playing Pokemon Go and getting out there and maybe not having the best of times all the time.
That's certainly a case. At least as we've spoken of, for some people down in Australia, there was the big kerfuffle of, residents of a condo complex being right across the street from a park, a public park that became a Pokemon stop.
Like a hotbed of crazy amounts of activity 24 hours a day.
Certainly, yeah, late at night, huge congregations of people, which no doubt you can find in a lot of open public areas.
Oh, I mean, here in Winnipeg, Assiniboine Park is crazy, to my understanding, because of Pokemon Go.
It is. Also, the Forks here in Winnipeg. And strangely enough, there's been times when, say, I've driven past the Forks at the base of the Provence Bridge, if you are in Winnipeg listening to us. Basically right at that, you know, little nook that along the bridge right next to the new Canadian Museum for Human Rights. And the amount of people just congregated there playing Pokemon Go at midnight, 1 or 2 a.m. is crazy. Crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy. But people enjoy playing Pokemon Go to all hours. And if you are one of those people who lives, say, across the street from a park where Pokemon Go is happening routinely, it can get very bothersome. So much so that a couple from St. Clair Shores in Michigan have launched a lawsuit against Niantic, Nintendo, and the Pokemon Company over it. They are suing this couple. They are Scott and Jamie Dodich of St. Clair Shores in Michigan. They are suing Niantic, the developers of Pokemon Go, to try and get them to stop from putting Pokemon on or near private properties unless they already have the blessing of the property's owner. The lawsuit asks that a share of the revenue from Pokemon Go be given to residents whose properties are claimed to have fueled the game's wild popularity. And this lawsuit has been launched in the Federal Court of California, even though the couple lives in Michigan. I mean, the main source of the couple's complaint is that they live in a home that is near a park that is a popular Pokemon Go attraction, and it's creating all sorts of just chaos and calamity they feel in their life, as they go on to also explain in their lawsuit that they're fed up with Pokemon Go players walking on their lawn, looking into their windows, and even swearing at them in some specific cases. The couple live across the street from what's known as Wobby Park in the Detroit area, which is a Pokemon Go gym, and there's also 7 Pokestops in the nearby area. The lawsuit says, quote, hundreds, end quote, of people come by on any given day. They also say in the lawsuit, quote, nobody gets sleep anymore. How is this acceptable? They hang out on our lawns, trample landscaping, look in vehicles. We don't feel safe. I don't feel safe sitting on our porch. The lawsuit also says that, quote, the defendants have shown a flagrant disregard for the foreseeable consequences of populating the real world with virtual Pokemon without seeking the permission of property owners, end quote. Niantic, for their end of things, they've not yet commented on the lawsuit. And as you can imagine, with all sorts of lawsuits like this in the United States, there is, again, the seeking of monetary restitution.
Of course. Of course there is.
I mean, so much so that I don't think it's any accident that the lawsuit claims that Pokemon Go has reached 30 million downloads and brought in more than $35 million. How that lawsuit or the...
How that number is relevant to people's flower beds being trampled, allegedly, is your guess against mine, basically.
Pretty much, I'm sure, to demonstrate that, hey, they've got the money, and this is a popular thing, so therefore, give my clients millions of dollars.
Yeah. So, the first problem I have with that, obviously, is the crazy claim that Pokemon Go is what is responsible for people looking in car windows, apparently, and trampling flower beds and landscaping and stuff.
Yes, the game, the app, being responsible for just stupid human behavior.
Yeah, so the thing about that is you're looking at your phone to play this game. You're not looking anywhere but your phone to play this game. First of all, I've played this game. I know. Second of all, you don't actually have to walk in someone's yard. You just have to be sort of close enough. It's based on loose GPS on your phone, which is not accurate to, you know, within like
inches,
feet. Like it's accurate within like half blocks, certainly. Like maybe like 30 feet increments, maybe you might get some sort of movement. But like if your yard's being trampled, it's because people are stupid, not because they're playing Pokemon Go.
It's true.
I mean, if one is happening as well, they, you know, it's just the fact that they needed a reason to do it. Right?
I would imagine so.
Like, I don't know. I'm not defending Pokemon Go. I'm not defending dumb person behavior, but this does sound like a cash grab to me.
Oh, I think like, this
of
was
the highest order.
This was only a matter of time.
Yeah.
I mean, given the surge, absolute surge in popularity that Pokemon Go had after its release, I'm surprised this didn't happen sooner, to be honest.
Yeah.
Someone looking to cash in, filing a copyright infringement, patent infringement idea, some sort of claim that way, seeking millions of dollars, saying Niantic and Nintendo and Pokemon Company stole their idea, some sort of patent troll lawsuit, something to that nature. It's oddly specific that this couple from the Detroit area, or perhaps just outside Detroit in Michigan, suing all because there is Pokemon in a park, which is a public park.
Yeah. So, and all, I don't know, all the rest of the part of the claim just sounds made up and unsubstantiated. Like them not feeling safe on their porch anymore or because people are trampling their yard and looking in their car.
That's one of the parts of the claim I don't necessarily understand. I was always led to believe and made to understand that more people in an urban and suburban area, just more people out and around in a neighborhood would make it feel safer.
Yeah.
That's more eyes on the ground, more eyes and people about, more foot traffic, to just make other people in the area feel safer. So it's not just one person walking alone down a street and that's the only person you see. It's whole congregations of people are around.
Yeah.
So then others might see that and exit their houses, feeling that there's just more foot traffic in the neighborhood.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's true. But looking in cars, no one's doing that when they're playing Pokemon Go. No one. I guarantee you, no one is looking in a car. If they're looking in a car, it's not because of Pokemon Go. It's because of whatever other reason that they have to be looking in random cars. Maybe the person was already a car thief.
That is a good point.
I mean, let's be real here.
Car thefts happen.
Car thefts are not new.
They are not. So we shall see how this lawsuit, which strikes me as a frivolous lawsuit.
Oh, absolutely.
But we'll see how the court ultimately decides, as it's again filed in the a federal court in the state of California, despite the fact that the claimants live half a country away in Michigan.
Well, we all know that sometimes courts are picked based on statistics, based on different types of cases. Maybe this type of case has a better chance of being successful in that particular district.
That's true, too. And another question I have just before we move off this is, has the couple made any attempt to reach out to Niantic themselves, use the submission form to try and get a Pokestop removed?
Yeah, I mean, if they're that concerned, fine. But I don't know. If I was Niantic, I would do a little bit of investigation. Maybe it's possible that they did that, did a little bit of investigation and determined, but you seem to live like a few blocks away from this park. How could this possibly affect your house?
Mm-hmm.
Like, so what if people were walking down your street? Like, did you just need some reason to file a lawsuit? What if their neighborhood was already like a high foot traffic neighborhood? Do we know this? Pokemon Go has certainly helped increase foot traffic all over the place.
It certainly has.
But, I mean, come on.
it's true. It may have been a high crime area already. Perhaps that is something Niantic could present as a defense and be like, look, this area had problems already. Our app had nothing to do with this.
Yeah.
And be like, hey, judge, so can we toss this out?
It's like throw this case right in the garbage because it's just clearly a money grab, right?
Thanks, guys.
Thanks. Bye.
And I'm sure the attorney, or it would not surprise me, I should say, if the attorney has a motivation of trying to make this a national class action lawsuit with other people who feel the same way and have had their flower beds trampled.
Oh, yeah. Or make it some sort of precedent-setting thing where, you know, against GPS-based, like, geocaching-type games and stuff, like, you have to be respectful of this and that, and you have to follow our rules. We need a whole set of rules for these types of things. Even though, like, there already are trespassing laws and stuff in place, so what more do you want? If someone's trespassing on your property, tell them to get the hell out of your lawn, and then if they refuse, call the cops. Like, the rules don't change just because, like, the delivery mechanism of the crime is slightly different now. Like, trespassing still trespassing. If you're playing Pokemon Go and you're thinking of trespassing, don't. Just don't do it.
It's true.
No Pokemon is worth, you know, the risk of getting arrested.
Having Pokemon Go open on your phone is not really a valid claim of defense.
No.
Against a trespassing charge.
No.
So, there's that. So, again, Pokemon Go, not an excuse for stupid behavior. So, don't be stupid.
Yeah.
There we go. But speaking of stupid, that is a claim that some people have been leveling against Konami this week, as they made a big surprise at the Gamescom conference in Cologne, Germany. Perhaps the biggest piece of news to come out of the event of this week, the kind of European big video game trade show event, kind of their version of E3, although kind of differs in that they have, you know, 1 or 2 days just of media access, and then the remaining weekend is only for public access to get on the show floor, play the demos, see the booths, that kind of thing. But no, Konami certainly grabbed a lot of people's attention when they revealed that they have a new Metal Gear game in development that is set for release sometime in 2017 on Xbox One, PlayStation 4, and PC.
Yeah, so this comes as a big surprise to me, especially because I was under the understanding that first they were getting out of the big video game business and moving towards pachinko. To the point where even we ended up seeing a scrapped Metal Gear Solid 3, I believe it was, HD remake, like footage from it being used in a Metal Gear themed pachinko machine.
Mm-hmm.
Much to the internet's chagrin. It's like, this is what Metal Gear has been reduced to. So when this came out, certainly many people raised a Spockian eyebrow to say, what? You're back in video games now? So it might not be a AAA video game. Maybe it might be, I don't know what you'd call
double or single A?
Like whatever a not $60 plus game is and whatever maybe a $50 to $60 game is.
30 to 40 maybe?
Maybe whatever that would be versus the high price, but that's what this one might end up being. But that was my first reaction, surprise. And then I saw the trailer, and then it was just kind of, my brain started turning in a bunch of different, maybe crazy conspiracy theory type ways.
Well, before we hear your conspiracy theories, let's fill in some people who maybe don't quite know what this is, and then we'll let them form their own opinions and share our thoughts about it. But this Metal Gear game that was shown off is called Metal Gear Survive. It's not directly associated with Metal Gear Solid. It's just kind of loosely affiliated with Metal Gear Solid.
Yeah, so in the trailer, you see Snake for about, what, 3 seconds? 5 seconds, maybe?
I believe it's Big Boss because it's set of Ground Zeroes.
Yeah, so it's Big Boss Snake, essentially. We all know that Snake is a clone of Big Boss.
Yes.
I mean, that's just sort of like, spoiler alert, there's been a bunch of games where we know about this. but we saw him for like 5 seconds, just kind of like making a brief appearance in a helicopter that's flying away.
Flying away from a big military base that's just crumbling and being destroyed. And then right at the end of it, you see things start to levitate and float. And you wonder what the hell is going on. And then the camera pans to the sky and shows wormholes.
Yeah. So leading you to think, oh, so I guess there's like an alien type involvement of some kind now. Something involving outer space or alternate dimensions or something like that. Okay.
And alternate dimensions is correct, because for some reason this game takes place in an alternate dimension.
That's the other part. Yes.
A whole bunch of members of the remaining members of Militaire Sans Frontières have been sucked through a wormhole, taken to an alternate dimension where they must survive and try to get themselves the heck out of there and back to Earth Prime.
Yes, and what they have to survive is what looks to be hordes of zombies, essentially.
Who have some weird metallic virus affliction thing affecting them.
Yeah. So basically this looks like a, you know, like a Resident Evil game really of the past like 10 years.
Yes. Before we saw and knew what Resident Evil 7 was.
Yeah. So really like this looks like it's trying to channel Resident Evil 4 through 6.
Yes. With some elements taken from Evolve, because the gameplay-wise, it's a four-player stealth co-op game.
Yeah, that as well. So nothing about that screams Metal Gear.
No, it doesn't. But according to Konami's European president, who spoke, said in a press release about the game, quote, Metal Gear Survive will offer a fresh take on the series' famed stealth elements, but within a unique co-op setting that is designed for a truly engrossing multiplayer experience, end quote. So, Metal Gear Survive, again, quick rundown, four-player stealth co-op, alternate Earth, alternate dimension, nothing to do with Solid Snake, Big Boss, Revolver, nothing of that.
No. So, my thought, when I saw this, my heart sank. And I thought, like, my first thought was that, oh my god, maybe there was some CEO or higher up at Konami at some point, or somewhere up the chain, higher on the chain than Kojima, that really wanted to see some sort of elements in Metal Gear that he was never seeing, that Kojima wasn't delivering story-wise, and he was being disappointed. And kept requesting certain things to the point where he finally just had enough and maybe lost it and just, you know, had Kojima fired because his ideas were not being listened to.
Mm-hmm. One of those executives who thinks that they know best.
Yeah. That's what, that was the impression I got when I watched this. It's like, now he's gone, we can finally have my alternate dimension alien idea. That's the direction Metal Gear needs. I don't know if that's true. Don't quote me on that. But people have been fired for stupider reasons
than not getting along or hearing and acting upon the stupid ideas of a higher up.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, they certainly have been fired for less things in many different organizations. I don't know. I can't say that's an impossible idea because everything about the ideas of this game scream, we're trying really hard to make it different.
Yeah.
And we're trying so hard, it's bad.
Yeah, it doesn't look at all like a Metal Gear game. Like, why even have the title Metal Gear?
Conceptually so far, I mean, we'll see ultimately what the game is like when it releases sometime next year, and that's, you know, I guess will be the ultimate way to judge it, but before that, as we only have a 2-minute trailer to go by to try and hype its release and get people interested and talking about it and create buzz, and it's certainly created buzz, but a lot of it is negative thus far. People on the internet reacting poorly to this trailer, showing off the new direction of Metal Gear and Metal Gear Survive, and why are there zombies? Why? Why?
No, I mean...
Why are there alien zombies?
Like, Resident Evil has moved away from this whole thing because it's sort of a tired genre now. The whole, like, let's fight off hordes and hordes of zombies to survive. This game's been done a million times before.
Mm-hmm.
A million times. Like, I can think of, like, tons of different games where this has already been done and probably done more entertaining because they're not... Like, it was a standalone thing that never had this baggage of a huge series franchise, you know, attached to it to make you think that it's going to be something different. Like this, like when I see Metal Gear Solid attached to something like this, I expect certain elements in the game. I expect a Hideo Kojima game. It's just, I guess that's what happens when someone kind of puts like an indelible, what, 20-year mark on a franchise?
20 to 25.
Like, he's sort of like been this big champion of the franchise. Now he's gone. Now you leave it in someone else's clearly incapable hands. I mean, maybe that's not fair to say. I don't know. Maybe it'll be more Metal Gear-y than the trailer made it look. We did see Big Boss in it, even if it was just to basically introduce the trailer, then fly away in a helicopter.
It almost seemed like that was just to give it some loose attachment to the existing Metal Gear universe and say, oh, these mercenaries from Militaire Sans Frontières, you know, they're connected to that universe and that's why you should care about them, even though you know none of them. Like, none of them are even fringe characters from the previous Metal Gear universe.
No, I mean, when I saw that one first character that they went to, I thought, is that like Chris Redfield or something? Like, who is that?
They look generic. There's no point of interest made about them, or it's not really conveyed why we should necessarily care about them. What's interesting? What can we connect to them about as people or individuals?
Yeah, or what? Where in the Metal Gear mythos do they fall? Is that like, is there some nod that like this guy might be like the son of Revolver Ocelot or something? Like where you might see him spinning a gun or some, they could have done their loose references to the series better than just 2 seconds of Big Boss before he flies away in a helicopter. And I can't stress that enough. He flies away in a helicopter. It's just basically like, you're on your own now. Bye. That's what it looked like. It's like I'm handing off the torch. It's not my franchise anymore. Bye.
Run with it, boys. It's like, and I can't help but think that's the only reason why that snippet was in there. And probably also because that was just an existing asset Konami had. Because this game is making use of the Fox engine that powered both Ground Zeroes and Phantom Pain, and no doubt helps Konami save some money.
Yeah, like, why design too many new characters when you could just use Solid Snake again? Even if it's just to have him fly away really quickly in a helicopter.
Now, the point I feel needs to be made is there is room in the existing Metal Gear universe as established by Hideo Kojima to do spin-off games, to go in directions that maybe weren't explored.
Yeah.
Those
spin-off games should be rooted in the universe of Metal Gear Solid.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Revengeance, Raiden being a cybernetic badass was already set up. So having a game about his cybernetic badassism isn't too far-fetched to think. Like, okay, futuristic cyborg game featuring this futuristic cyborg that was a futuristic cyborg in a game already. Okay, cool. I mean, portable ops, or like those portable games,
the Metal Gear Acid and stuff.
Like even going back to the PlayStation 1, VR missions, it was just an extended version of something you could already do in the first Metal Gear Solid game.
This is also true. I also mean that there's room within the story and backstory of the characters. There are whole universes and backstories of characters that really you could expand on and explore. Otacon.
Yeah.
You could explore that. I mean, we would only see characters in bits and pieces as they related to the Big Boss Solid Snake storyline. Wanna, you know, go off and explore what Revolver Ocelot was doing for whatever period of time.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to make like a survival game, I'm sure you could dig up something more believable than alternate universe aliens, maybe? Like throughout the whole series history, there have been supernatural elements. Like, that's not unheard of.
No.
I mean, they had like characters with weird, dubious connections to the spiritual world and stuff.
The Sons of Liberty from the second game.
Yeah, or even if we go back to the first game, there were guys like Vulcan Raven, who was sort of supposed to be like a Native American type shaman type character, mm-hmm. implying that those shaman powers are real. You know, he had crazy powers of intuition. He knew tons of information about Snake just based on whatever type shaman powers he had, or Psycho Mantis, who had psychokinetic abilities, could read your mind.
Hell, Vamp.
Vamp is a vampire. He's supposed to be an indeterminate age and is essentially a vampire. So, I mean, these types of things are not uncommon or, like, unheard of in the Metal Gear Solid universe. But you kind of need to tie them in a little bit better. Like, you can't just be super blatant about it. You have to kind of like sneak it in on the side and like make it seem like they're being used ultimately by the military for some reason or something. Like,
well, and this is one thing I had to go back and check, is just to make sure that Metal Gear Solid 5 did not have wormholes, and that's what Konami's picking up on to justify the direction of this new game. No, it didn't. The closest there were in the Metal Gear 5 games between Ground Zeroes and Phantom Pain was the wormhole Fulton extraction device, which you can conjure up, can put together and assemble towards the latter part of the game.
Yeah, and I mean, like, the Fulton extraction stuff was like an extent, like, it sort of like evolved over the course of like two or three different games anyways, so that wasn't unheard of, but to just jump right into like, oh, wormholes, another dimension. Like, where did that come from?
And even then, I just think that was a quicker way to send things back to your base anyway.
Yeah.
It wasn't a wormhole to another Earth.
No.
Or another planet.
Or another dimension. Or
no.
Aliens involvement or something. Like, no, it wasn't anything like that. It was just like, get people onto your base faster. That's all it was.
This really feels like Metal Gear jumping the shark. Like,
oh, yeah.
The first attempt at a non-Kojima Metal Gear game, and it's just already shark over it on the other side.
Yeah. Or maybe not. We don't know if it's on the other side. It may have fallen in the shark tank, for all we know. This game has not come out yet.
That's so true. We don't know what else awaits us.
Yeah.
I don't get it. None of the main characters that we're supposed to care about to try and survive on this alternate Earth, none of them seem interesting, or we were given a reason why we should care. Like, nothing about them, their name, their backstory, their motivations or anything. Nothing.
Yeah.
Just, hey, it's this person. But it's action, because they have to defeat hordes of somewhat zombie-ish zombie things.
Yeah. So, great. Can't help but think that it was just some sort of executive with some idea, mad that Kojima didn't listen to him, got Kojima fired as a result. Can't help but think that. Maybe it was aliens, maybe it was zombies, because, you know, zombies have been a hot item for a few years now.
Mm-hmm.
And Metal Gear is not typically known for having zombies in it.
This is true.
So maybe it was a thing like that, like, we need to have zombies. People like zombies. It's like, no, but people still like Metal Gear just as it is.
Our market research tells us that people, they enjoy zombie video games.
It's like, oh, but what does our market research tell us about all of the successful games we already have that are not zombie-based?
I don't care. We paid a lot for this market research about zombies.
It's like, oh,
okay. We have to justify it somehow.
It's like, okay, I don't want to make that game. You're fired! We're going to run your name through the mud, Hideo Kojima.
The weird thing that we find ourselves in, or weird moment we find ourselves in with this game now being revealed, is that we have a Metal Gear game that is trying to be like a more recent Resident Evil game, when the now most recent Resident Evil game is trying to be like old Resident Evil games.
Yes. So I don't know. We'll let you know more about this one as the story progresses.
Oh, there's going to be more to talk about between now and when it releases at some yet-to-be-determined time in 2017, but over the course of that time between now and then, no doubt we shall talk more about VR, virtual reality headsets, because that is the technological rage these days that just will not go away until everyone loses their shirt over it.
Yes, because
that's what it will take.
Yeah, and I don't know, basically based on how hard everyone seems to be pushing for this to succeed, I don't know if that'll happen sooner than later, but it may happen, it may not. I'm not seeing VR pick up the way that I think they would like yet. Maybe we'll have to give it a couple of years, but Intel seems to think that they want to get into it as well. So they're now throwing their hat into the whole VR headset ring because the big number of VR headsets that were already out there was not enough.
No, they need to further saturate the market because they have the key to cracking the VR marketplace. It was this week in San Francisco at the Intel Developer Forum that company chief Brian Krasnick showed off that what Intel has obviously been working on for a while, it's something that they're dubbing a mixed reality headset, and they're calling it Project Alloy. They say it's compatible with Microsoft's Windows holographic platform, and by mixed reality, we mean that it can do both augmented reality and full virtual reality.
Well, potentially. Also, potentially, maybe something entirely different. Information given to devs is very vague and not really there yet. Intel does plan, apparently, according to Krasnick, to release an open source version of Project Alloy's hardware specs and APIs late next year, which could very well be what VR needs to have a big open source thing. But part of me thinks, like, wait a minute, don't we already have some resources available to us with Google Cardboard and whatnot already?
You'd think. I thought there were some out there, but I believe while that is further developing and continues to grow, Intel is hoping that the fact that this is a standalone headset will be enough to entice consumers and also developers as well to develop games and other pieces of media for it, because this is a headset that will be powerful enough, according to Krasnick, to run most current VR games. Now, it might not be able to handle them all, which is a variant that must be attached to a PC, or there will be maybe a variant model of it attached to a PC, or can be attached to a PC down the road.
Yeah, but there's an interesting, kind of maddening quote from Krasnick in here. And he says, and I quote, "But for 90% of what people do with VR, it's perfect and it's untethered." What is 90% of what people do with VR? Do we even know that yet? How many people are using VR that we can make a bold claim like, oh, 90% of people do this? Do we know this yet?
I don't think we do.
I mean, I know almost no one with VR technology, and I work in the tech field with a bunch of like tech savvy, techie people. If I don't know anyone with VR, I can't make even sort of a little bit of a claim as to how people use it.
Perhaps things are different down in San Francisco.
Maybe, but I mean, that Silicon is the, Valley.
That is the hub of technology in North America and for the better part of the world. So I can imagine there being a lot of people with early adopter mentalities down there wanting to get in on it because it's the latest technological thing,
yeah,
device to have as part of, you know, a status symbol that you can show off and say, hey, I have this, therefore judge me accordingly.
Yeah. So I don't know. But I guess like just the final thing to say about this is that while you might be thinking it sounds very much like HoloLens, you're probably right, but unlike HoloLens, the prime focus of this is supposed to be VR as opposed to AR. So I mean, while it will do AR, I think they're trying to sell the VR aspect more than HoloLens.
Indeed, Krasnick pointing out and stating that Project Alloy is intended as a VR headset first.
Yes.
And not really as concerned with augmented reality, even though it can do the augmented reality. Now, if only there is a way to do augmented reality and virtual reality at the same time.
Yes.
I don't know how that would work without driving someone absolutely insane.
But speaking of other VR, it's the OG VR to many people for this current generation of VR. I don't mean like old things like the Virtual Boy or previous, but this current generation would be the Oculus Rift. And it's sort of crazy that it's been out for so long in people's minds that it hasn't actually officially been released yet to the public.
That's true. Some parts of the world have already acquired it in America, but other parts of the world have still just kind of been waiting, twiddling their thumbs, wondering what's the deal.
But the thing about acquiring it in Canada, you've never been able to acquire it as a consumer. You've had to buy it as a developer. You've had to get the developer version of the headset. You had to go through their developer program to buy it. It was never just like buy the commercial release.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is kind of crazy because it's been a few years at this point now.
It has. And I mean, it released commercially in March in America, in the United States. Yet we here in Canada traditionally get electronic devices and at least media things,
about platforms. The same time as the US.
Certainly. So this, a staggered release because Oculus this week, in a blog post announced that on September 20th, consumers in Canada will finally be able to get their hands and eyeballs on the Oculus Rift in a commercial consumer setting. It's currently available for pre-order through the Microsoft Store, and when it's released, it will be available through Best Buy retail outlets.
Yes, though it's going to have a bit of a steep price tag. It's going to be about $850, so... So if you want to get in on that, be my guest. I'm going to hold off on VR for now if that type of cost is going to be associated to it.
Now, also on September 20th, it's not just consumers in Canada who will be able to pick up the headset, but our European counterparts will be able to acquire it as well. It has, you know, Oculus did not specify which countries in Europe will be getting it, but I assume they mean all of them. I don't know. There's a lot of countries in Europe. Yes. So
if you're in Belarus, you're in luck.
If you're in Belgium, you're in luck. Kazakhstan?
Maybe not.
Over there, it will retail for 699 euros or 549 pounds sterling. However, to further entice people, and much like the United States, when they got the Oculus Rift, Canadian consumers and European consumers will be able to get Oculus Rift boxes that already come with the platformer game Lucky's Tale inside of it. So it comes packaged and bundled with a game already to really show off what the Oculus Rift VR headset is all about. Woo!
Good thing.
Exactly. The game, or there will also be demo games included for The Climb and the movie Henry, amongst other demos to be included. I assume there will be like the old PlayStation demo discs.
Oh, probably.
With just a smattering of everything on there.
And maybe in due time, we will see this next game appear on a VR demo disc, or maybe a full release for VR sometime. But not for quite a while, because the actual release is being delayed by a couple months as it is.
That's true. It's been many, many years in development already.
Yeah, so what's a few more months? Probably would just mean a better game. If you're complaining about that sort of thing, don't. Because I'm sick of buggy games coming out needing huge day one updates. But the game we're talking about is Final Fantasy XV.
Indeed, the game that was set for a September 30th launch date has now been pushed back by 2 months. Almost exactly 2 months, as it's now pegged for a November 29th release date. So almost exactly 2 months to the day from its original release date of September 30th. If that is on your calendar, in your phone input there, delete it, scratch it out, now move it over to November 29th. The message, your to-do item for that day, pick up Final Fantasy 15.
Yes, so as we said, we don't need to get into it super deep with crazy quotes or anything, but the development team does need more time to put spit polish on it, which is essentially a good thing to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of refreshing anytime we hear that it's just like, no, the developers definitely need more time, as opposed to like just some weird unforeseen fake sounding sort of like excuses we might hear, like, oh, we ran into some sort of problem with the manufacturing. It's like, yeah, no, you didn't.
Here's one thing I've always wondered, though. When we hear these game delays for only about a month or 2 months, a relatively insignificant amount of time, with the reason being given as more time for spit and polish, needs more elbow grease, needs to look perfect for, you know, to make, get it to the experience level we want for our fans, blah, blah, blah. How much more time can the development team actually put in?
Yeah, and I mean, at what point have they reached tunnel vision where they're not making any sort of progress anymore because they've just been kind of staring into the abyss for too long?
Is the 2 month delay to give the dev team like a 3 week break and be like, hey guys, brain bath, come back, hit it super hard.
Yeah, maybe.
And like live here for a month.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, it's entirely possible.
Just because, again, 2 months is not a significant amount of time. We've seen Nintendo delay games by 6 to 8 months. God knows how long Mighty Number 9 was delayed time and time again for ultimately needing more spit and polish. You can understand that there's actually a lot of work that has to go into it because there's a significant amount of time that the game's been delayed by. So, I mean, in this case, with a game like Final Fantasy 15, it's going to have a huge development team.
Oh, yeah. Gigantic.
So perhaps that is the trade-off. It doesn't need as much time of a delay because there's that many people.
Yeah, I mean, it's also possible that a lot of this is just more QA time where they need it more in the hands of their testers to, like, really refine certain test paths and really make sure that certain things are working properly,
mm-hmm.
which is good. I mean, we don't really... And a company like Square Enix can, when they say they're devoting 2 months to something, we know they're not just like a small team of like 30 people like Hello Games or something working on No Man's Sky. They are like actually a AAA studio with like hundreds of people at their disposal. So they can just say, okay, we're giving it to maybe multiple QA teams within our corporate structure to just really hit certain areas of the game. Be like, here's how you get to the area. Here's how you test it. Here's what we're looking for. Go.
Mm-hmm.
Here's your test scripts. Note all of the things in our ticket tracking software, and then, you know, the devs will address things one by one, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, I guess it's all a matter of scale and stuff, too. So they might be able to really do a lot in a couple months.
Just with a little bit extra time, just from a lot of people.
Yeah.
And that's a fair point as well. If you're looking forward to Kingsglaive, the Final Fantasy tie-in movie that is coming out, its release date has not been affected by this. It is just the game, Final Fantasy 15, that is set for release on November 29th. Kingsglaive will come out before that.
Yes, movies don't typically require debugging, and I mean, I assume. I don't make movies. I make software, but... You know, anytime I've made anything in a linear nature that people can enjoy like that, I've never had to make sure that it worked properly other than just that is the microphone on for our podcast? Oh, then it's working fine. Okay, cool.
Fantastic. So that is something to look forward to. At least the movie will tie you over and keep you going until Final Fantasy 15 comes out. Although that is kind of late. That is late into the Christmas shopping season.
Yes, so that'll be a dangerous time to go to the mall to pick it up if you're going that route.
And that's basically right after American Thanksgiving, when it is widely perceived and believed that Christmas shopping will be in full swing by that point, and the malls will be super crazy, elbows will be up, and everyone will be bowling each other over to get to the mall, get what they need to get, and then get the fudge out. But, well, at least one last item we certainly have to talk about this week. It's not something that looks forward in time necessarily. This is something that was announced this week that looks back in time. One of the staples of Call of Duty games in recent years is that they'll have an expansion or an additional pack for them involving zombies, zombie hordes, and basically just you as some characters not tied into the warfare game or whatever Call of Duty game necessarily, just killing a whole bunch of zombies in some ridiculous manner. Additional content meant to entice a lot of people to pick it up and play it who perhaps may not have had any interest in the Call of Duty game proper that this zombie mode is tied into. Kind of goes back to a number of years ago when there were zombie or Nazi zombies included as an additional download pack for one of the Call of Duty games. And since then, Activision has seen fit to include a new zombie mode each year with each additional Call of Duty game, and the one for Call of Duty Infinite Warfare, this year's Call of Duty game, has been announced, and we know that what the zombie mode is going to be this year, it's titled Zombies in Spaceland.
Yes. And so Spaceland is some sort of wacky theme park area that is just sort of, I guess, a stage that you can go to, and it's overrun by zombies.
It's not...
Hilarity ensues.
Not only is it overrun by zombies, it's set in the 80s.
That too. So
Neon ahoy.
Yeah, neon, polyester, all the different staples of the 80s are in full display on in the trailer for it anyways, which you can find a link to on our website, thearcadeshow.com.
And you have your typical 80s archetypes in there. You have your captain of the football team or quarterback of the football team, Jock. You have your awkward nerd voiced by Seth Green. You have your bimbo valley girl. You also have the rapper wearing his, like 80s styled Kangol tracksuit.
With like Adidas runners kind of thing.
Yeah, basically imagine LL Cool J from the 80s.
Yeah.
That.
Or like the Beastie Boys or something like that.
Or the Beastie Boys, exactly. And as has been the trend in recent, zombie packs for Call of Duty games, Activision opening up the wallet to shell out for some name talent here in the, to do the voices in this game. They have lined up Seth Green, as I said, to do the voice of the awkward, you know, nerd kid. I believe Poindexter is his name in the game, but they also have, Jay Farrow, who was most recently on Saturday Night Live doing the voice of the rapper. They have Paul Rubens, most famously known as Pee-wee Herman, more recently playing the father of the Penguin on Gotham.
Which is good casting, I think.
It really is. Also in the new Pee-wee Herman movie on Netflix.
Yeah, anytime there's Pee-wee Herman, you can't have a Pee-wee Herman movie without Paul Rubens. He is Pee-wee Herman.
It's true, and Pee-wee Herman, or Pee-wee's Playhouse, certainly a staple of the 80s. I mean, when you think 80s, that is 80s.
Yes. You know what else was 80s?
What's that?
Knight Rider.
That was a very 80s TV show as well.
And they did tap David Hasselhoff to be in this as well. So that's, he rounds out, I mean, there's a few other people in there as well, but he rounds out the big major celebrity names, I think, for this Zombies in Spaceland expansion.
Now, if you're wondering what David Hasselhoff is doing in this, he is playing an enigmatic DJ in the theme park who apparently is going to be helping the four characters survive through their time in Zombies in Spaceland, or sorry, Spaceland as it's known, because the characters in the game don't know that the game is called Zombies in Spaceland. Excuse me, but they do know that apparently they've been cast and are being watched by the fictional movie director Willard Wyler, who is being voiced by Paul Rubens. The idea being the director has brought these actors, aka the four characters who play, to this theme park to have them audition for his movie. And then calamity ensues. Yes. Vicious zombie-based calamity. So, this game, or this pack, this additional content, Zombies in Spaceland, is going to be on display from September 2nd to 4th at Call of Duty XP, the big Call of Duty convention that Activision puts on in Los Angeles. It will release on November 4th, again, with Call of Duty Infinite Warfare on PlayStation 4 and Xbox One. So Activision really, really throwing out the enticements out there to try and get people to pick up Infinite Warfare this year. There's Zombies in Spaceland with, again, David Hasselhoff, Paul Rubens, Seth Green in there, 80s, a lot of Michael Jackson Thriller-style references in there as well. But there's also, of course, the remake of Call of Duty 4, Modern Warfare, and its map packs coming back. So they really are throwing it out there. Like, hey, this is stuff people like and want. Let's please God, buy this game. Please buy this game. So this actually continues a trend, as I've said, of Activision shelling out for kind of big name talent to do voices in these zombie games. I mean, last year for the zombie mode in Black Ops 3, they had Heather Graham, Neil McDonough, Ron Perlman, and Jeff Goldblum doing voices.
Yeah. And I mean, these are just the zombie modes. These aren't like the main story modes either, which is also, they're no strangers to getting major talents for those. I mean, Kevin Spacey lent his voice and his likeness to, the Advanced Warfare.
He sure did.
Which was kind of crazy. So. I mean, he looked a little dead and kind of like weird. It's just weird to see a 3D version of a real person that you know exists in real life and is also a dynamic actor and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it was really cool that like they got Kevin Spacey, you know, one of probably arguably the finest actors of our time.
Certainly has to be on that list and in that conversation.
Which is, yeah, I mean, a video game.
Exactly. So Activision, they've got the money and they kind of need you to buy it, this game, so that they can continue to have the money to pay these actors to be in the games. You know, that kind of thing. Money, profit, yada yada, etc., etc. Amen.
Indeed.
But that was our last news item for this week's episode. But as you know, we're not quite done yet. If you've listened to this program at any point in the past, which no doubt you have if you're listening to us, or if you're new, welcome. You can explore previous episodes on our iTunes account, on Google Play, on our website, thearcadeshow.com. And when you listen to them all, you'll find out and notice the trend that we always end off each episode by saying goodnight, even though it might not be nighttime. But before that, we get to our last segment, which is The Blast from the Past, which we're going to get into right now.
Yes, because The Blast from the Past is a thing that you probably either forgot existed or didn't even know it existed, and it's a thing that might be celebrating, well, we always like to make it timely these days, and say it's a thing that's celebrating some sort of timely anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
This week is a movie that's celebrating a 10-year anniversary, and it's hard to believe it's a 10-year anniversary already.
It's a movie that was very much an internet darling.
Yes, which is kind of crazy that the internet has been sort of like this social thing for at least 10 years now. Because I remember before it was a social thing and where like just interacting with people online was done through the archaic form of forums or
instant messaging, MSN Messenger, IRC chat.
Yeah, things like that. So
AOL, chat rooms.
Yeah, ICQ as well.
That's true.
But yeah, like once MySpace and all those other social networks started to kind of pick up.
Oh God, MySpace.
This one sort of definitely benefited from the emerging meme culture that sort of was emerging at the time. This movie was Snakes on a Plane. Now, you might not remember Snakes on a Plane, and I forgive you, but it was, I mean, it's some people, I loved it. I thought it was ridiculous. I thought it was so outrageous. Some people don't like Samuel Jackson sometimes for things like this, but I don't know. I think it's fine. It was a movie that essentially, it's my understanding that the working title was Snakes on a Plane. When they wanted Samuel Jackson to be in the movie, he signed on to the movie because he thought the Snakes on a Plane was the real title. they were going to change it to something, and then he threatened to leave if they changed the movie title from Snakes on a Plane to anything. Cause like, I signed up for Snakes on a Plane. I'm going to be on Snakes on a Plane. It's like, okay. So
the movie title is what sold Samuel L. Jackson.
Yeah. And it's what sold a lot of us when we saw this movie for the first time, because really it's like the whole plot of the movie is summed up essentially in this title, but it's not, it's a movie that's not so much about the plot. It's more about like what ridiculous stuff can happen with that happening on a plane. So like, obviously like, well, there's snakes on a plane. Now what?
Not just calamity ensues, but all kinds of ridiculous calamity.
Yes.
Ensues. And it's a movie that didn't try to do these scenarios of what happens when snakes are unleashed on a plane in a serious manner. It very much was trying to channel old schlocky movies.
Oh, absolutely. To the point where they even did a test screening of what they thought was the complete movie, and then it didn't get the big, you know, reaction that they were hoping for. So I think they took some sort of poll and asked people what they would have wanted, and I think they ended up just saying they want some big, stupid, goofy speech done by Samuel Jackson for people to rise up. So they specifically wrote in and reshot the whole climactic scene something like 8 weeks after the movie was finished wrapping, like after the shoot was wrapped. So, and that was that whole, I want these, you know,
mother effing
snakes off of this mother effing plane thing, which is when I first saw that, I lost it. I saw it in the theater and I think I laughed for like 10 minutes solid because I couldn't believe that like something like that had been made.
I think that was even used as a focal point and selling feature in the trailer, was it not?
I think so. But just in context, it was just so jarring and like it knew how ridiculous it was. It's like I'm watching a self-aware movie that knows how ridiculous it is and it's not even trying to dial it back even a little bit.
Now, let's be clear, it isn't necessarily a good movie.
No, but it's...
It's not trying to be either.
Yeah, and it's one of those movies that... It's entertaining for that reason. It's entertaining in the same way that, like, a classic Schwarzenegger Stallone movie might be entertaining. Like a Commando or like a Cobra or something mm-hmm. like that. Or like a Tango and Cash. Like,
yeah.
You don't watch those movies because you want... you know, an Oscar-winning performance. You watch those movies because you want to see stuff blow up, you want to see goofy special effects, and you want to hear silly one-liners because that's entertaining and you want to laugh at something ridiculous. That's why this movie exists, and for that reason, it does a great job.
It does. It certainly does. However, the internet darling status it enjoyed prior to its release didn't really carry over when it was released. It is regarded as a box office flop.
Yeah, I mean, it made money. Like, it cost $33 million. It made $62 million. So it wasn't a failure. Like, it didn't lose at the box office No. or anything. But, yeah, like, it was one of those weird cases where people hyped it up because of the ridiculous name and because of the ridiculous trailer. Then when it came out, people were somehow surprised that it wasn't a great movie. It's just kind of like...
Imagine that.
Yeah, imagine that. It's like...
A movie called Snakes on a Plane is not going to win any Academy Awards.
It's like, what were you people expecting? It's like, I watched it. It satisfied what I thought it was going to be. And for that, I enjoyed it. But I guess other people had other ideas as to what they thought it should be and... had a bunch of complaints, and thus the internet sort of, you know, thing was, even though it was in its infancy, it was already early on established what the internet was like for criticism of things. So.
Fickle.
Fickle.
To put it mildly. It was everywhere. I mean, it was getting hyped out the yin-yang prior to its release. I mean, August 18th of 2006. It just became a phenomenon before it ever was released just because of the ridiculous premise of it and how there hadn't really been a major Hollywood picture done with such a ridiculous premise, starring a, you know, major A-list actor in Samuel L. Jackson for such a long time. I mean, it was a throwback to 80s movies, but there hadn't been a movie that really threw back to 80s genre films in quite some time like this.
Yeah.
But it did not do as well. I certainly remember seeing it in theaters, but having a bit of a different experience because how I'll describe this is some people, when they hear nails on a chalkboard or something, just get a shiver up their spine. They don't necessarily have to see it. It can be the sound of it has that trigger effect on them. It just makes them physically uncomfortable. For some people, it is, you know, seeing the sight of mustard, as we've seen freakouts on the Maury Povich show. You know, their great phobia or thing is mustard, and they'll have a freakout or what have you. I can't stand seeing snakes on television. I absolutely hate it. It just makes my skin crawl. I do not enjoy it. Them slithering all around. No thanks. I will change the channel. So I had to sit through this movie in order to watch it. I don't like watching snakes on screen. The whole premise of this movie is snakes get loose on a plane.
Well, fair enough.
This movie was somewhat torturous in that regard. Not to do with the premise, the plot, or whatever, just I don't like watching snakes on screen. It's weird, I will fully admit, but that is my quirk. Everyone has them. That's just mine. It's now out there in the world. Deal with it.
Well, fair enough.
I'm taking ownership of it, damn it.
It's all right. I mean, I'm like that with spiders and stuff, so it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Don't care about spiders. I'm okay with snakes, so I didn't mind it, but I could see if that was a issue, fine.
Although I do recall, and I do, and will forever remember, towards the end of the movie, once the, you know, captain and, or the pilot and co-pilot have both been incapacitated, if not killed.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly what happened.
But. They're looking for people to try and fly the plane. Samuel L. Jackson can't fly the plane.
And so. It was the most fantastic, stupid movie thing I can think of.
So
they did.
Kenan Thompson, previously of Kenan and Kel and Good Burger, and I think had maybe just started on SNL at that point, had, you know, was in the movie just as a passenger on the plane who's just constantly playing his PlayStation portable the whole time.
Yeah. He was well established that he was a video gamer. He was supposed to be one of the character's bodyguards, I think, because I think there was like some
rap guy.
Some rap guy or something on the plane. And his bodyguard was this, you know, was played by Kenan Thompson. And it was sort of established near the end of the game that the game he was playing so much of was a flying simulator. So then, of course, because he was like, he stepped up to the plate and was like, I put in over 10,000 hours on PlayStation flying. I'm practically a certified pilot. Then he landed the plane, big happy ending.
With Samuel L. Jackson in the co-pilot's chair. All because he learned on PlayStation.
Like, I laughed so hard when I saw that. It was the dumbest thing. But it knew how dumb it was. Like, as they were doing it, you could tell, like, they were just, like, winking at the camera going, you know how ridiculous this is. We know how ridiculous this is.
It was the right amount of stupid.
Yeah.
And actually, one other video game tie-in I feel it has to be pointed out. In the Wii game Trauma Center, Second Opinion, one of them, it's sitting on my shelf right now, there is a stage in there called Codicis on a Plane.
Yes, now Codicis is, of course, the medical symbol of the two snakes going around the
winged thing.
That whole snaky medical symbol, you've seen it before.
Yes, that's a codicis.
Yes.
Two snakes facing each other, called Codicis on a Plane. This movie was called Snakes on a Plane.
Yes.
And the poster image was two snakes wrapped around a plane, a jetliner.
Just like a codicis, but around a plane.
Yeah. So, a nice symmetrical tie-in. Nice nod to, I'm assuming the, you know, game was nodding to the movie?
Oh yeah, probably.
Because I can't imagine it working the other way, where the movie was nodding to the game, so I always found that interesting, slightly bizarre, and I kinda just was astonished that the level was called Codices on a Plane, given how recently Snakes on a Plane had come out. So for those of you out there, Trauma Center fans who were perhaps unaware, Codices on a Plane, that level, references Snakes on a Plane. There you go.
Indeed.
So there you go. Snakes on a Plane, good chance you've never heard of it, or if you have, it's just been in passing, perhaps someone on some thread or posting on someone's social media page that an image or meme or whatever from Snakes on a Plane. There you go. Came out August 18th, 2006. Not necessarily good, but it's an experience.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, don't expect an Academy Award winning movie.
No.
But if you like just a good, silly movie that knows it's silly and kind of over the top, like a Commando or whatever, check it out. It might be for you. It might entertain you for a good hour and a bit.
Mm-hmm. And if not, well, then you can say you tried.
Yeah.
And you know what all the fuss was about from 10 years ago. So that is certainly something that we suggest you check out. I assume it's on Netflix at this point or in various other forms that you can watch it. I'm sure we don't have to go into any great detail about that. You know how that works. But certainly we look forward to hearing your feedback on Snakes on a Plane and how you enjoyed it, watching it either again after so long or for the first time. You can email us info@thearcadeshow.com. Use the Contact Us form on our website, thearcadeshow.com. Or send us a message on Twitter. Follow us. We are at The Arcade Show. Or drop us a line on our Facebook. Give our page a like. We are facebook.com/TheArcadeShow. Or bizarrely, in the reviews of our page on iTunes. That wouldn't seem the most appropriate avenue for this, but if you're at a loss for words to leave on our iTunes page, okay, that works. But since you're there, I mean, why not give us a review and a rating?
Yeah, I mean, how hard is it just to click a number of stars, preferably 4 or 5?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, come on.
Doesn't hurt.
Doesn't hurt.
I mean,
might even do us some good.
Exactly. So there's that, and I assume there's some sort of rating system for the Google Play Store as well.
Probably. Thumbs up, I guess.
Sure. Do that thing for that page as well. Again, you can find the links to everything on our website, thearcadeshow.com. Well, now that we've shilled for enough things and told you about Snakes on a Plane, which pretty sure you did not expect to hear about this week because no one's ever prepared to hear about Snakes on a Plane.
It's like the Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects Snakes on a Plane.
Exactly. We shall bid you adieu and simply say, until next week, good night, everybody.
Good night.